dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people who provide a better reading on intelligence matters and certainly bring more intelligence to bear in journalism, especially with respect to national security, than our first guest. He is Bill Gertz, who I'm very pleased to say graces us each week about this time, from the Washington Free Beacon, where he is a senior editor, also the author of the prize-winning Inside the Ring column at the Washington Times. He is the author of seven now best-selling books, including the newest, iWar, about national security in the information age. Bill, one of the most vexing things, I think, about the new Trump administration has been that there has been exactly one presidential appointee under President Trump in the entire Defense Department, as best I can tell, until very recently, namely the Secretary of Defense himself. There's been a thrash between him and the White House about a woman he wanted to bring in as his Undersecretary for Policy, Ann Patterson, a Muslim Brotherhood supporter, for God's sake. She's out, but several others are in. Patrick Shanahan at the Deputy Secretary slot, David Trachtenberg as the Deputy Undersecretary for Policy, Grover Norquist's brother as a comptroller. Tell us a little bit about these personnel choices that are finally breaking through.
After a long delay and obviously a big battle between the White House and the Pentagon, they've begun picking people. For the deputy, this person is a former Boeing executive, I believe. And I think this obviously is going to bring his corporate experience. Usually the number two at the Pentagon is in charge of managing things, while the number one, Mattis, will be in charge of more policy and more public things. Like I say, there have been reports that a key person on the transition, Mira Ricardel, was battling with Mattis over these appointments. And she's moving on to another post at the Commerce Department. And now there seem to be, they need to get these working level people in place. And again, it's always an indicator of what kind of policies we're going to have is by what kind of people are picked. And until we get to the assistant secretaries, like for Asia and for Europe, it'll be hard to tell what direction they're going. But there was one troubling appointment, which was Patrick Cronin was appointed to the PACOM, Asia Pacific Security Center, which is the Pacific Command's think tank. And he came from the Center for New American Security, which is a Democrat think tank. So a lot of angst, especially among China hands, about the direction the Pentagon may be going on that front.
Well, this is indeed troubling. Let me ask you about the subject of your book, iWar. Bill, you've recently written at the Washington Free Beacon about how the United States has essentially been disarmed in the information warfare space, certainly relative to the efforts that the Russians and Chinese are making in that area. Talk a bit about what the implications of that might be.
Well, as I outlined in my book, iWar, they had a hearing this week, first of its kind, actually, for the House Armed Services Subcommittee on Emerging Threats. And they had three experts testify, including Michael Lumpkin, who until recently was the key person in charge of the war of ideas against Islamic terrorism. And he basically said that there's no direction and a lack of strategy. And that was echoed by another guy named Matthew Armstrong, a former USIA official, who also said that there's no awareness of the threat, there's no priority for information warfare, and there's no strategy. So basically, we're losing. At the same time, we're under an information assault, as we saw during the 2016 election with the Russian influence operation. Two other examples were our China's information warfare operation to covertly take over the South China Sea, which is going on without much resistance. And then, of course, on the Iranian front, there was the Iranian information warfare operation to convince the world that by signing this nuclear agreement, they were going to limit Iran's nuclear program, which is, again, going to be open for business in 10 years at the early, if not sooner. And, of course, they got billions of dollars in frozen assets as well. So there's a real need for developing new information warfare capabilities. And it was a real eye-opening experience. One of the testimony from Matt Armstrong was he said he was told by a Russian information official that the propaganda organ RT, which is so pervasive in spreading Moscow-oriented propaganda, he told them that there would be no market for RT if the U.S. media had been doing its job. So it's really highlighting the fact that we have no counter-propaganda efforts and we have no way to promote the ideas of American values of freedom, democracy, and free markets.
Bill, talk, if you would, a little bit about a report that you filed this week about the apparent use by Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen of exploding boats that are remotely controlled and the threat that that represents to some of the world's most strategic waterways.
In January, these Iranian-backed rebels, which are seeking to take over Yemen at the very southernmost point of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, are developing, with Iranian assistance and design, drone explosive boats that are designed to be able to remotely pilot it and ram into shipping, either commercial or military shipping. And it's all part of a larger Iranian strategy of encirclement of Saudi Arabia. The Iranians already control or threaten the Strait of Hormuz, where a large percentage of oil shipping passes. And now they're focusing on another strategic choke point in the Red Sea, the Bab el-Mandeb, which is, a large percentage of global oil shipments pass through this basically a two-mile strait. And now you've got these remotely piloted explosive boats in that part of the world. So things are really heating up on the Saudi Peninsula.
Well, in fact, the distinction I think that you've pointed out is for people who aren't interested in conducting suicide operations, this provides another means of trying to accomplish the same end, and is obviously a very, very problematic development. And again, made possible in part, presumably by the windfall profits, I guess you'd call them, that the Iranians garnered under Barack Obama, enabling them to spread their terrorist activities and operations far and wide. Speaking of Russia, Bill, let me ask you about one other story you covered this week. The hacking by the Russians of Yahoo on the one hand and their seeming inroads into Egypt on the other are two very, very ominous strategic developments. Give us a quick readout on those, if you would.
Yeah, on the first part, the Justice Department this week issued an indictment against two Russian intelligence officers, along with two criminal hackers, in a massive cyber attack against Yahoo, stealing some 500 million email accounts or access to those accounts. It was quite an extraordinary operation, and it highlighted this idea that the Russian intelligence service is working with criminal elements for the first time. You know, it seems like for the last 8 years under the Obama administration, there was a hands-off approach to Russian intelligence operations. In fact, Russia itself, as Obama sought to reset relations, at least until the very end of the administration, when they finally expelled 35 officers for the election hacking. But now we've seen a glimpse of the kind of activities that they're doing. This is kind of a new trend. The Chinese and Iranians are also using private hackers with their government cyber warfare experts to break in and steal data, as well as do influence operations. On the Egyptian side, the Pentagon is somewhat concerned about the movement of Russian troops and drones to Western Egypt, where the Egyptians seem to be getting Russian support to help one of the factions in the Libyan civil war, General Haftar and his factions. And that's certainly raising concerns because Egypt has been such a close U.S. ally and reliant on U.S. security assistance for so long. Now it looks like they're shifting to the Russians, and that's raising new concerns.
Much more on that to be followed up in the days ahead. Bill Gertz at the Washington Times and the Washington Free Beacon, thank you so much for joining us each week. Paul Coyer joins us from the Institute of World Politics. We'll talk with him about another aspect of Russia's activities at the moment in Belarus. All that and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's a great pleasure to be able to welcome to our microphones one of the brightest young men I've had the privilege of getting to know recently. He is a contributor to Forbes.com, a research professor at the Institute of World Politics in Washington, D.C., and a professor associate at the French West Point, known as Sancerre. He is Dr. Paul Coyer. It's always nice to catch up with him briefly. Hello, Paul. Welcome back.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Let me ask you about a subject you've been giving a lot of thought to. There's much thrashing around about it, but it seems a lot more heat than light is being generated by the thrashing, namely about Russia. Paul, you've been studying the Russians for a long time. What would you say is afoot there at the moment, and what are the implications for U.S.-Russian relations as you see it?
Well, currently, and the piece that I wrote most recently for Forbes was on the what I call the near revolution going on in Belarus. Over the past approximately 5 weeks, there have been major street protests that were triggered by a tax issue, but really represent much deeper issues. But what that says, I think, writ large about Russian-Western relations and the Russian mindset is illustrated by how Russia has interacted with Belarus, its probably most loyal client state over the past several years, with thinly veiled threats in the Russian media that involve hints that Belarus isn't and never was an independent country, which of course is false. References to the fact that 10% of the Belarusian people are
Russians and therefore have to be protected. Like we've heard this this show before. What is the likelihood that you'll see the Russians intervening once again to crush independence-minded or pro-Western-minded, perhaps, populations there?
I think that's a threat that Lukashenko or Lukashenko, depending on whether you pronounce his name with Russian phonetic spelling or Belarusian, the leader since 1994, has been trying to forestall that possibility of Russian aggressive intervention by cracking down on the protests themselves. He started to do so in the last couple of days since I wrote my article. Just getting the leaders and hoping that quells the disturbance. The last thing he wants is to see Russian aggression on his territory because, first of all, it's self-interest. He wants to rule Belarus. Secondly, about Russia really actually coming into Belarus with little green men or anything of the sort that we saw in Crimea or eastern Ukraine. Honestly, I think despite Russia's saber-rattling, that's relatively, it's probably not going to happen. Simply because Putin doesn't have to do that. He's got a couple of lines of defense before ever getting to that point. One is pushing Lukashenko to crack down himself. And number two, Russia completely controls the Belarusian economy in every possible way.
I'm not a student of this, as you are, Paul Coyer, but I've always thought that Lukashenko was basically the Kremlin's cat's paw anyway, and that the kind of Stalinist practices that he's engaged in were a reflection of the kind of control that that suited the Kremlin. Is that not the case?
No, I think that it is. But again, looking at the larger picture, I'm a historian, so I look at broad historical sweeps, and I do believe, I don't believe in being on a right side of history, so to speak. That's a narrative that you tend to see on the political left that believes in progress. That's what the term progressive comes from. I don't agree with that. I believe that history is what we make it. At the same time, I do believe in human nature shaping history, and I think human nature yearns deeply for autonomy, for self-government, and for freedom. So I think that you can see that coming to play now in Belarus. And in that sense, I think people like Vladimir Putin, Alexander Lukashenko, et cetera, are really pushing against, not history, so to speak, but they're pushing against that deeper yearning in human nature. And in the end, they're not going to win.
So, Paul Coyer, then back your historian's lens up, if you will, and give us a flavor of what the latest developments in this particular sort of microcosm of Russian foreign policy and its conduct means for U.S.-Russian relations at a moment when we're hearing a lot of Democrats, among others, talking about a new Cold War.
It says, first of all, that they need to be handled with a lot of caution, if for no other reason that it really, the current events in Belarus play on Putin's fears of another Maidan, of him losing Belarus to the Russian sphere of influence like he had Ukraine. Once you do that from a strategic point of view, Russia has lost any strategic depth between it and Europe. But looking at it from their perspective, again, I don't want to sound like I'm a Vladimir Putin defender, because I most certainly am not. And Sputnik writes stories about how bad I am. So, you know, that being said, looking at it from not just his perspective, but many Russian nationalists, when you have NATO on your borders in the Baltics, you know, NATO on the Black Sea, and not just Turkey, but now Romania, et cetera, it kind of plays on the historic Russian paranoia. And if they lose Belarus as well, after having lost Ukraine, the Russian paranoid conspiracy theory mindset is going to kick into overdrive. You can already see it in Russian media, and they're going to be certain that the United States government was behind it, even though I doubt we had anything to do with it whatsoever. We're as surprised as anybody else. And when you deal with a government that is motivated by and acts upon paranoid conspiracy theories, that's a dangerous place to be. So the relationship is going to have to be handled very, very carefully.
Given all of that, what do you make of the Russian involvement that has been alleged in our elections, and more generally, the kind of effort that Donald Trump has talked about making to accommodate the Russians?
Yeah, I think on the first score, I tend to think that the mainstream media has been parroting the same line as the Democratic Party. And I think the motivation
for
that...
Well, that's shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
I've never seen that happen before.
I think the primary motivation really is so petty and partisan as to try to delegitimize Donald Trump's election. I noticed that yesterday, speaking to a bunch of relatively senior diplomats and academics from here in D.C. and around the world at an event in Washington. And one of them, whose name I won't give you, but he was a former very well-known foreign minister from one of our European allies who was very, very left-wing. And they were all parroting the same line that, of course, Donald Trump is a marionette for Vladimir Putin, and Putin won the election for him, and he hacked the election, quote-unquote, with the implication that he manipulated votes, which, of course, is ridiculous. I completely reject that. I do think Russia was involved in hacking the DNC. That's obvious. But I think that the DNC has only itself to blame if they had not done things that would make a mafiosa blush. They wouldn't be so angry about it. Now, you know, getting remind me of your second question after that.
The main point is whether, in fact, the prospects here, and we're pretty much out of time, but just very quickly, the prospects here for U.S.-Russian relations are going to be influenced adversely by either Trump's desire to make nice with Putin or by Putin's actual agenda.
It makes it, Putin's mindset and the Russian mindset, to be very quick because we're running out of time, as you said, makes it more difficult to do that. But I do believe that Trump has a much better chance of reaching some sort of a limited accommodation. I don't think there are enough overlapping interests to make a large one. But a limited one, Trump can, I think, reach because of his personality, the fact that he has dealt around the world with very difficult personalities and you know, mafiosa types. Successfully. So I think that he, more than anybody else, has a decent chance of making that happen. Something that happened this past week that also very few people realized was that our chairman of the Joint Chiefs was in Turkey meeting with his Russian counterpart, which meeting would never have taken place under Obama. And I supposedly they were just talking about logistics and how we keep out of from stepping on each other's toes in Syria. But when you have someone that stellar in the stratosphere in our and their military firmament speaking, they're not talking about logistics. You usually handle that further down the line with lower level generals, which tells me that they were trying to reach accommodation on something broader.
we will be trying to trace what they've been doing in the days ahead with your help, I'm sure, Paul Coyer. Thank you so much for the great work you do at Forbes.com, as well as IWP, a very important institution in Washington, D.C., and at Sancerre for Franco-American relations as well. Come back to us again very soon, if you will. We'll be speaking next with Sam Rohr of Faith Leaders for America. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by a man I've come to admire tremendously, both as a public servant for some 18 years in the House of Representatives of my home state, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and also as a leader in the faith community, specifically the president of the American Pastors Network and also the Pennsylvania Pastors Network. He is Pastor Sam Rohr. I've had the privilege of getting to know him a bit in connection in particular with one of his newest ventures, which is something called Faith Leaders for America, a tremendously impressive group of men and women of various faiths and denominations, and Sam Rohr is one of the leading members of their executive committee. In other words, what you're getting is a counterpoint to the so-called interfaith dialogue, well, industry, I guess it's fair to call it these days, that has been sponsored by, in many cases, and certainly exploited extensively by the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States. And I just wanted to say, Sam, as you look around at these clerics for hire, if you will, what kind of support are they providing? How are they enabling the effort in the name of tolerance, it seems, to promote the most intolerant operation on the planet at the moment, the Sharia supremacist agenda?
Yeah, well, Frank, you mentioned, and I didn't mention that specifically, but that is exactly what has precipitated the matter of Muslim Brotherhood strategy of trying to infiltrate faith leaders across America, some even across the whole spectrum of faith leaders, attempting to convince them and having them stand up and say that all gods are equal, Allah is the same as the Judeo-Christian God, and then ultimately by saying within that that the Muslim Brotherhood and radical jihadism is in fact peaceful, is in fact of a similar type and vein as to religions normally viewed in America, and there's nothing to be afraid of, nothing to be concerned. That level of deception is what we believed need to be countered, because it is leading the American people, it is leading leaders in government to wrong conclusions, which if not soon addressed, Frank, is going to result in the loss of freedom in America as we know it, and it's going to result in the loss of ability for churches in America and religious leaders who have enjoyed religious freedom. They will soon lose it if and when the impact of Sharia under the auspices of the Muslim Brotherhood in fact takes greater hold in America. So this is a matter of freedom, Frank, and this is why the Faith Leaders for America have been speaking up and saying, no, jihadist Islam is not just like any other religion. It is a political system. It is not a matter of peace and love as Christian and Judeo belief is. It is all about persecution of those in a one-way only belief about how to live and how to impose law and rule over a country. So it's a complete totalitarian system, Frank, masquerading as peace and love, and trying to use religious leaders for hire, I put it that way, to substantiate and to confirm that position. But we know historically and accurately and currently it is not the truth, and that's why it must be spoken out against. And that's what Faith Leaders of America is attempting to do.
Yeah, well, this is an incredibly important undertaking, needless to say, especially as a moment as we see President Trump trying to exercise his authorities, both under our Constitution and under statute, to prevent the migration to this country of more people who seek to impose, you know, a way of life or values, as you've described them, Pastor Sam Rohr, that are antithetical to our Constitution and the freedoms it guarantees. And specifically, I'm struck by the role that some of these religious leaders for hire have been playing in denouncing his executive order on an immigration pause and promoting the efforts of those who were trying to restrict it. The faith leaders for America, some 100 clerics or more now, have opposed a so-called biblical interpretation that requires that kind of embrace of the stranger without regard for whether the stranger is trying to destroy your country. Talk a little bit about your recent open letter to the president and vice president on that subject.
Glad to do so. Yes, we believe that there were two primary moral positions that are being assumed by, and again, I'll use this word, religious leaders for hire, Frank, that have condemned the president's immigration policies, the intent to increase vetting for the purpose of immigrants, for the purpose of protecting the American citizen. They have taken a position that the president and any increased immigration policies are uncompassionate, demonstrating that we don't love people, and that's an historic Christian position. We need to love people, and that by restricting immigration, it is a denial of that basic principle. And secondly, they pull up a principle of saying that the Bible speaks about needing to and being commanded to embrace the stranger, the immigrant, and by turning anybody away, it's a denial of what the Bible says. And we countered that on two perspectives, saying it is wrong on a number of fronts. Number one, the use of the word stranger in the Bible is used two ways. One, and this is the critical point that they miss, one is a stranger that wants to come to your country, come to America, because they want to participate in our system, they want to obey our laws, they want to assimilate into our culture, and they want to become a part of this nation that has become the United States of America. That's what the Bible says relative to strangers in the past wanting to go to Israel. They wanted to become a Jew. But there was also the stranger that the Bible talks about that were enemies. In the book of Isaiah, it clearly talks about, because Israel at that point did not guard who came into the country, did not do what they needed to do for their people, they actually allowed into their country, same word, stranger, but a different Hebrew word. This one means an enemy, a person who, as the book of Isaiah says, actually, because they let them in, they were burning their cities with fire. They were pillaging their people and their lands, true enemies. And God said, because you did not do what I said, now the enemy, stranger, is within your midst, destroying your people. So, Frank, that is what they fundamentally are misinterpreting, two types of strangers. What the president is doing is, let's identify the immigrant who wants to become an American. Let's keep out the jihadist Islam or other people. We've had these laws in the past where we've kept out Nazis, where we've looked to keep out people who were defined enemies of the country. And what we've said is that what the president is doing is both constitutionally correct, it is historically based, and it is biblically correct. Now, there's one other fundamental article point that we talked about in the letter. Not just a stranger, but the concept that the role of government is not the same as the role of the church. Meaning, it is not to reach out and just bring in and put your arm around everybody to help them as the stranger in the ditch. The purpose of government is to enact justice. You protect those who keep the law, and you punish and discipline those who break the law or violate the rights of the law-abiding citizen. That is exactly what the president's doing, Frank.
This comes down to the wise welcome, as the Bible would put it. This is very important. Needless to say, your clarity on these issues, Sam Rohrer, and that of Faith Leaders for America is really needed and so appreciated. And I hope that we will hear more of your multi-faith efforts in this very important debate and a lot less of the so-called interfaith dialoguers. Keep up the good work, my friend, at the American Pastors Network, and come back to us again very soon if you would. Next up, we'll drill down more on this travesty in the courts concerning President Trump's executive order on immigration with freedom-fighting lawyer Rob Muse. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's my great privilege and high pleasure to be able to welcome a great American who has, among other things, myriad connections to the land we're celebrating on St. Paddy's Day. He is Rob Muse, a fighting Irishman by virtue of his law degree from Notre Dame University. He is a remarkable resource on matters involving the law and national security, informed by his experience as a combat Marine veteran. Also, his time spent with the Thomas More Law Center and now with an extraordinarily important public interest law firm, the American Freedom Law Center, of which he is one of the founders with David Yerushalmi, two good friends and great colleagues of ours. I'm very pleased to have Rob Muse with us to talk a little bit about this judicial, well, malpractice, it seems to me, with respect to the president's revised executive order on immigration. Rob Muse, welcome back. It's good to have you, and happy St. Paddy's Day for you.
Oh, happy St. Patrick's Day to you as well, Frank, and great to be with you as always.
So am I wrong in describing this as malpractice, given what we know about the executive order and the ruling that's been now handed down by this judge, Derek Watson, in Hawaii to block its implementation?
I quite frankly, I think malpractice might be a little bit too light. This is a very dangerous decision. It's one that this judge had absolutely no authority to issue. I mean, under the Constitution, the powers of the president to deal with matters of national security and foreign affairs is virtually plenary. I mean, the courts have even developed a doctrine called the political question doctrine, where they realize that their authority does not go into such matters, and they are not permitted to resolve those types of issues.
And this was, in fact, in a ruling from the Supreme Court itself, as I understand it. Is that right?
It's an entire doctrine that has been developed through multiple rulings from the Supreme Court, and appropriately so. You know, a court is in no position to decide what is in the best national security interests of the United States. The court is in no position to decide what our policy should be vis-a-vis other foreign nations. Zero. I mean, quite frankly, this is getting very close to an impeachable offense, in my view. So, you're going a little light on this, judge, to say that this is just legal malpractice. This is dangerous precedent.
One of the reasons why it's a delight to have you on, Rob, is you're my legal counsel. So I'm delighted to be able to inform and improve my my game here. When you look at what has been done with this order, at the behest, let's be clear, of a Sharia supremacist in Hawaii who is claiming that he's being irreparably harmed because his mother-in-law can't come to this country for 90 days under the executive order. It does seem as though it's not simply overreaching. It is bizarre. And
The upshot of it, in addition to the one you've mentioned, Rob, of course, in terms of infringing on the president's powers, is to create a whole class of people who have rights that has never been contemplated, as best I can tell, under our Constitution, nor is it comprehensible how they could be given the ability to exercise those rights to come to this country. Talk a bit about that, if you would, please.
No, you're exactly right. And if you obviously, a country without a border and without an ability to, to defend that border from those that they deem to be dangerous, I mean, you no longer have a country. I mean, so even if you grant that this, plaintiff had this irreparable harm by not being able to have his mother-in-law, come over here, which is absurd when you balance it amongst the other competing interests, there was no basis for issuing an injunction in this particular case. I mean, there are such grave, strong public interests to ensure that this order is in place that it absolutely trumps, no pun intended, this claim of irreparable injury of not being able to, see your mother-in-law within 90 days. But that's, that's even getting beyond the point that the court has absolutely zero authority to interfere in these particular matters. Our government is co-equal branches of government, lest we forget. And there are certain areas of government that the courts should not interfere with. They are not legislatures. We see it all the time, which is a problem. They legislate from the bench, but they're certainly not foreign policy experts. They have zero authority in that area.
Rob, I understand that if in the event that we see the Ninth Circuit do what it did the last time around, which is essentially validate this malpractice, malfeasance, overreaching, however you want to describe it, that this would go to the Supreme Court, at which point the American Freedom Law Center would likely offer an amicus brief in support of the president's position on this. Talk a little bit about the legal theory as you see it going forward.
Well, certainly, and because we obviously, as an organization that has grave concerns about our national security and are battling, those fights here domestically. And certainly we want to uphold the president's authority to deal with a foreign threat to our nation. And so it'd be absolutely, I think, imperative that we weigh in and we give voice to these concerns. So it's real important. And, I think I even heard it was either earlier today, Alan Dershowitz, the Harvard law professor, he said this thing is dead on arrival at the U.S. Supreme Court. And I fully agree. Even leaving aside the fact that the president has such, literally plenary authority in this particular area, the argument that this somehow violates the Establishment Clause because the nations that we happen to target, the ones who breed jihadists, are happen to be Muslim, so this somehow violates the Establishment Clause, it's absolutely absurd. And I've heard arguments too where people have said, well, there's no evidence that anybody from those countries actually came here and committed a terrorist act. Look, the job of the president is to prevent a future terrorist act, not to wait till one occurs and then point back. And oh, by the way, does this judge seriously think that these nations that have been identified aren't breeding ground for jihadists who have adverse interests to the United States? I mean, the whole underlying, factual basis, legal basis, every aspect of this ruling is just fundamentally wrong.
Let me just ask you, even if the president were actually trying to prohibit people from coming to this country on the grounds that they are Sharia supremacists who don't share our values and who are therefore, as far as he's concerned, a threat and should not be admitted, is it within his constitutional and statutory authority to make that definition of the bearing of the bar to such immigration?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And nobody has anyone who is a foreigner to this nation has zero rights to come to this country. Zero. I mean, there is no we don't give constitutional rights to the Taliban in Afghanistan or Al Qaeda or anybody else or any other resident of these foreign nations. They're not American citizens. They don't have constitutional rights. They have no right to be here. The president can limit who comes into this country, foreigners, for virtually any reason. Like I said, that authority is plenary. But to tie it to a direct national security threat, my goodness, that is unassailable. And it's no business of a court to say what is and what is not.
Rob, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. There's so much more to talk about, and we'll look forward to covering this story with you as we get further along in this saga. If you want to help express your support for what President Trump is doing in trying to protect our country, folks, I hope that you'll check out immigrationpause.org. Rob Muse, thank you for your time today and for all the great work you do at the American Freedom Law Center for God and country. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again on Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.